411. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. Caught up in a vicious cycle of poverty, violence, and criminality, the black male has been identified as an endangered species. 12 Things Every Black Boy Needs to Know, written by Daryl Starks and Adika Trimble, Jr., provides guaranteed life strategies for coping with boyhood and becoming a man. They join us this hour. Daryl and Adika are in Atlanta. Joining me here in the studio, I welcome Terrence Stewart. He hails from Zephyr Hills, Florida. He is a sophomore majoring in pre-physical therapy. Terrence, welcome to 411 Teen. Brandon DeJesus, he hails from Jacksonville, and he also is a sophomore majoring in pre-med and biology. Let's start with, what was the impetus for writing the book, 12 Things Every Black Boy Needs to Know?
I guess I'll take that one, Adika.
Okay.
Okay.
This is Daryl. I grew up in a family where my parents stressed the importance of giving back to the community and looking out for people less fortunate than ourselves. So with that in mind, we grew up in a church with youth programs and doing community service. And as I got older, I realized that I wanted to find a way to continue the legacy that my parents kind of started and do something that really made a bigger impact on black youth. So the idea of 12 Things came along by just taking some simple adages that we grew up with, like things like don't burn your bridges and hands been dealt and there's always someone worse off than you, things that our grandparents and parents would tell us that I felt today's youth could benefit from if they understood what those things meant and how to apply them in their lives. So I started writing the book and writing all the lessons, and then about halfway through the project, I met Adika at the Boys and Girls Club and shared the project, and he liked it and joined forces and shared some new insights on ways we can do the book with activities and shorten things up. So together we co-authored 12 Things, and that's kind of the story.
It's a good story. Would you compare growing up today as a black male to growing up as a white male? What kinds of pitfalls does one encounter as a black male?
I would say that of course, I don't have any research data directly in front of me to support my theory, but just looking at the obvious, and when we look at the education of our black males that are in school and the dropout rates as well as the graduation rates, according to one of the census bureaus, the U.S. Census, it says by the time that they reach high school, about 42% of all black boys, African-American boys, would have failed an entire grade at least once. So it has a lot to do with, I think, the institutionalization of racism, first and foremost, Dr. Hollyfield, and then it has a lot to do with the way that our educators, our teachers, whom of which do a phenomenal job as best as some of them can do, how they are actually socialized, how they are educated. We have a lot of boys that tend to, and this is factual, go into special education, and that don't necessarily need to be in special education. Mm-hmm. And I can probably run off numerous names of individuals, having been a former educator in Mississippi as well as the state of Georgia, with a combined experience of teaching about 13 years. And sometimes it's intentional, and other times it's by circumstance that a lot of our boys get sidelined into special education classes. And then as they grow older, going through the educational system, usually about fourth or fifth grade is when you can tell that some boys are or will have some challenges. Jawanza Kanjufu, an educator and psychologist based out of Chicago, Illinois, even wrote a book about maybe I think about 30 years ago entitled The Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys, and speaks a lot about how a lot of times we love, you know, our daughters, as a lot of single moms are raising their daughters, but then kind of neglect their sons, and a lot of sons to go out and, you know, play ball or quote-unquote be a boy, but with the girls and with the daughters, they allow them to come in, get their homework. They have chores, you know, for the girls. Sometimes the girls are even given the responsibility of caring for their younger siblings. So that has been a lot of our experience in terms of the black experience. And, of course, it's not necessarily cut and dry across the board in every black household, mm-hmm. but just generally speaking, that speaks to, I think, a lot of the experiences that a lot of families in our communities go through.
Well, I have two black males sitting here with me in the studio, and maybe they can respond to that. Terrence, I mean, what was growing up? You're a sophomore now in college. What was growing up like for you? Did you leave a lot of your friends behind when you came off to school?
Hi, I'd like to say it's great to be here with you again. When I reached high school, the friends that I had, and you're right, around fourth or fifth grade, you do begin to notice that your friends are having, like, trouble in school and, like, little behavior issues, and they only got worse. And when I came here, I did leave a lot of my friends behind. Like, in fact, I'm pretty much the only one that did come here, so.
And how do you connect when you go home for breaks or?
I try to stay busy, mm-hmm. like, because I know that if I get used to falling into the cycle of, like, the habits they've fallen into, I won't want to leave home.
Mm-hmm. Brandon, what about you? What have your experiences been?
Well, it's an honor to be here. My experience is a little bit different because I attended Andrew Jackson in Jacksonville, and that high school is majority black populated. So to be here at FAMU was kind of like expected next step, you know what I'm saying, mm-hmm. for our school. So not many of my friends did follow me because of the fact that, you know, all black people don't go to college. But the ones that did go to college, a majority did pick FAMU to go to.
Okay. All right. Who was the book written for?
The book has a wide range of readers. We purposely titled it 12 Things Every Black Boy Needs to Know because mm-hmm. we wanted a black boy to be able to go into a bookstore and see a book that was written to him. But by the same token, anyone can read the material in the book and benefit from it. So we've had Caucasian mothers buy it for their sons. We'd have Hispanic mothers buy it for their sons, just in terms of race. Then we have young men in group homes. We have young men in detention centers. So it's a wide range of young men that the book is designed for. So we titled it the way we titled it for those reasons. And believe me, we took some hits in school systems with a 99% rate of, you know, African-American boys in ISS who still ask us questions like, well, what about the Hispanic boys, and what about the white boys, and the problems they're having are with black boys, but they still want to fight us on the title. So we took our hits, but we stood true to the fact that we wanted this book to be for black boys primarily. However, anyone else can read it, male, female, or whatever. Can I piggyback on something that Terrence said earlier?
Sure.
And he mentioned about this, the process of disassociating or really evaluating his friendships. And one of the first activities in the book is designed to help the young men understand the importance of, you know, identifying a true friend. We patterned it off the pact, the three doctors that made a pact. We kind of looked at that model of how they were at one point troubled youth and made a pact to become doctors. So we wanted to kind of duplicate that experience in the book so the young men can identify which true friends they have so they can hopefully form pacts to do the right thing and stay on the right track. So it's ironic that Terrence said that, but that is one of the first activities in the book for the boys to do.
And I would like to address that because I had that in my notes. I thought that was a very unique component of the book and a very valuable component, and I want to applaud both of you in including that in your book.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Is it a book or is it a cookbook? It's a little bit, you know, because I looked at it and I thought, it's sort of a cookbook. A lot of
different recipes.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of different recipes in it. And if I may add, for those listening that are listening actually to this broadcast, on page 8, when you ask who is the book for, the book itself is formatted in with a sports theme in mind, not necessarily a particular sport, but understanding that most boys, black, white, Asian, and the like, tend to gravitate just towards sports concepts. And on page 8, we have a sheet entitled The League. That page is titled The League and says this book is for, and we have four different leagues. And I believe one league is boys, another one is organizations, another one is adults, and then the fourth league is for programs. So for individuals that may be listening that need some extra support or looking for 12 things, every black boy needs to know it's for boys that are being raised by single parents, boys that are being raised by both parents. You know, boys in group homes, boys that think they know everything, boys that think that they might be, you know, or call themselves thugs or pimps or think that reading is lame, you know. It's for various organizations from schools to boys and girls clubs, churches, mosques, alternative schools, and, you know, and so forth and so on. And in terms of the adults, that kind of runs the gamut for all adults, whether it's grandparents who are raising their grandchildren, religious leaders, foster parents, and also the various programs, from mentoring programs to rite of passage programs. We've also been approached by fraternities, football camps, youth conferences. So as Daryl was saying, it just kind of runs the gamut. We have had, when we first finished the book, there was a particular parent. And she was really, she said that she felt like the book was for her.
Let me ask you.
She had, I believe, Sister Nabingi had three sons. And she really
Adika,
appreciated.
Can I interrupt you briefly for 1 minute? You know, we've got to take a brief break. Hold your thoughts, and we'll get right back at you. Tuned in to 411 Teen. Adika, I had to interrupt you. Would you continue?
Yes, there was one particular parent that had read the book, Sister Diane Jafarana Abingi, and she had at the time had three boys that she was raising as a single mom, and she stated that thing 9 and thing 10 was actually for her, particularly thing 9, which is don't blame your mother. That's the name of the mm-hmm. thing. There are 12 things, and each thing has a chapter. So it's like chapter number 9 or thing 9, don't blame your mother. And encouraging young men and the reader to take accountability for their actions and for their behaviors and not just blaming mom or blaming dad, as we talk about in thing 10. So this book, it just basically runs the gamut. Dr. Hollyfield, in terms of the boys' organizations, adults, and programs that that is catered for.
As young black males, how important is the role of that adult male or father in growing up? And that's open to all of you. I'll start here. Terrence.
It always starts at home when you, like, decide what you're going to do with your life. Like, you like to look to your parents. And I've always wanted to be like my dad. He's always been a good role model. He's always worked hard. And he's always tried to take care of like other people, even if they're strangers, you know, give them mm-hmm. a ride, find them something to eat if they ask, you know. And I've always thought that translates to being a good man, you know, having mm-hmm. a father figure that willing to put himself not for his family, but to sacrifice for strangers as well.
Okay.
All right. Well, honestly, I couldn't answer it the way he answered it because I didn't have a father figure. So I guess what he showed me was, in his absence, that he taught me that what I didn't want to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So exactly. So he set that example for you.
He set that example for me.
And that helps a lot. I think that gives you a lot of insight because you know what road you don't want to take.
Exactly.
Adika.
Yes.
Would you like to comment on the role of the father?
Yes, absolutely. With me growing up and even now, my father's played a vital role in my development, and I'm very, very thankful for that. And my dad is currently 95 years old, father's 95. He's still doing well. He's not on any medication. Just a few years ago, he got diagnosed with diabetes, but like I said, that was even in his 80s. Mm. So he's always been around, and he's even, seen me through college, was able to pay my way through college. We're speaking of an individual who was a retired custodian, so he didn't have a lot of education. He's one of the ones that had to go out and raise his brothers and sisters, go out on the farm. He has a 10th grade education. And so the role of a father is very, very important. That said, I understand, too, that there are a lot of fathers out there that wish they were able to raise their sons as well as their daughters, but maybe due to the circumstances where things may not have worked out, with the children's mothers, we do understand that. So I think fathers can still be involved as much as they possibly can, at least in raising their child, raising their son. And it's great that the young men in the audience on the panel have two different perspectives, because although 12 things and that we do have thing number 11, don't blame your father, we realize that a book cannot necessarily teach you how to become a man, not at all. But some of the things that we do recommend is for the readers of the book, or particularly young men who are reading the book, to seek out individuals that may be able to fill that void, such as an uncle or a coach, a teacher, or just a neighbor, or somebody that they may come in contact with. It might be a mom's friend. But it's just very, very important, and that actually kind of leads to another thing. Daryl, if you might want to maybe kind of expound upon the hands that's been dealt, but the fatherhood portion of it in pieces is really critical. And mm-hmm. a lot of the diseases that we're experiencing in our communities is as a result of there not being a father involved and or present. That's going to provide leadership, provide guidance, provide nurturing, and just be a provider and protector for his family.
And if I could piggyback on that,
yes.
I like how you left that protector off, because, one thing I'm finding as the role of a father is to also protect the mind of their children. And with all the negativity in music and media, there's so much that can poison the young mind if there's no one there to help them decipher those messages and tune some of that stuff out. So as these young people are growing up in a society as, I guess, as sick as it is, that they're introduced to so much stuff that'll take them off the right path. That sounds fun, that sounds cool, and sounds, you know, like they're supposed to be doing it, but, you know, the father, missing that father, a lot of times they miss protection from those type of things. So I think it's a very, very, very important piece. Attica asked me to expound on thing number two, and that is actually hands been dealt. And that's a concept, we put that as one of the first concepts in the book, because we realize that everyone has a different hand in life, but ultimately we wanted to inspire and encourage a young man to play their hand to win. So whatever your hand is, if your father was, you know, all four of us on this conference call were blessed to have our fathers, but there are a lot of young men whose fathers are deceased or incarcerated on drugs, not in the home, but you just can't throw him out. You got to keep him in your hand, but pull another card from the deck that will help you still win, be it an uncle, a mentor, a coach, or whoever that can help guide you in certain areas of your life to become a better man. One quick thing, also in field testing 12 things, I've been on about a 2 or 3 year field test in different organizations and alternative schools, and where we would have kids or young men do the different activities. Thing number 10, where it's don't blame your father, is the hardest one for them to do. That the forgiveness or the anger or this, all the pain that comes up dealing with these absent fathers is a really, really hard thing for young men to deal with. So there's so much healing that needs to happen in that area just for these young men to get past that point that would help them become more productive and become less angry and less mad at the world. So to answer that question, the role of the fathers is very critical. But in addition, the role of men in general stepping into these young boys' lives is also very critical.
How does one contact you? What's your email? Listening audience may want to purchase the book. Where do they connect? How do they connect with you?
Okay, right now I just got off the phone with the printer, so we are expecting some more books in this week. So the best contact right now would be my personal phone number, which I don't mind giving out.
Okay, would you share that with us, please?
Excuse me?
Would you share that with us, please?
Yeah. Okay, it's 770-873-6364.
And the email address is info@12things.org. That's info@12things.org. info@12things.org. Again, the number is 770-873-6364.
Okay.
770-873-6364.
Well, I tell you, I really enjoyed your book. One thing I liked particularly were the various proverbs or sayings that you had inserted throughout the book. I found these all to be very, very encouraging and very positive as far as the reading, and I think it was really a strike of brilliance. I like that. I think that it sent a real clear message.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're also on Facebook, 12 Things on Facebook, so you can find us out there on Facebook.
Why are young black males experiencing the difficulties identified in becoming self-sufficient black men? I mean, what role does the community play in this?
I work with African American males every day, and it's a combination of things. And I think a lot of it is a lack of delayed gratification. They want everything like right now. The Terrence and the other young men are in college, so they realize the importance of putting in time to get the big things you want, the bigger things in life, the bigger goals in life. But a lot of young men who are less patient want everything right now, so they want that quick fix or that fast dime rather than a slow nickel, however they say it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we got to teach them to be patient and commit to education, which will afford them more opportunities down the road. But when they see so many things in the community, especially in the impoverished communities, where it's like they want it right now, it becomes, I think, a lot harder for them. We had some young men at a conference about 2 years ago, and we were teaching them etiquette and life skills. And you know, one of the young men just stood up and said, you know, we appreciate you all teaching us all this, but as soon as we go back into the neighborhood, We have a dope man wants to do a run for him. We have a gang member over here talking in one ear. So it's like we can give them so much positivity, but at the end of the day, they go back sometimes to communities where there's so much negativity around them that they're getting pulled from both ends. So that the self-sufficiency piece is hard because there's not a lot of opportunities out there for them that are available right now. So they sometimes take that quick route to just help make mom, help make the ends meet, and a lot of times that's just really the wrong path. So I think we need more opportunities in the community to provide them with jobs and things along that line that will help them, you know, learn work ethic and earn a legal source of income while they're teenagers, and then they can, you know, I think aspire to be work, you know, traditional jobs or start their own businesses down the road because they had a foundation of and a good work ethic as a young man.
Brandon, I know you had a question or some comments that he was getting prepared for the program, so share them with us.
Oh, well, you already kind of like touched on my question, but I got some questions, though, you know.
Go right ahead.
All right. Okay, Attica and Daryl, you know, just getting a personal, you know, feedback. Well, first, let me go over the opening.
Mm-hmm.
You said black males are an endangered species or are endangered. That kind of stuck out to me, and I could, you know, I could feel where you're coming from on that because it makes sense given the situation. Mm-hmm. All right. For you gentlemen, I just wanted to ask, like, do you, because I think it was Attica that touched on black males needing, like, special education needs or something like that?
What I was saying is that the majority, when you look at given any class, particularly in an urban setting, most of the students that are in special education, a high percentage of them happen to be black males. Even at some of your schools where the schools are, say, maybe 50% black and 48% Caucasian and maybe even 2% other, still there's a higher number of black males that are in special education. And that's proven. That's across the board. Additionally, we find, and this kind of goes to the tenets that Dr. Hollyfield was mentioning in terms of black males being endangered, is I work in child welfare with the foster care system and CPS, Child Protective Services, and the last children to get adopted are usually black males. They're usually the last to get adopted. And particularly black males that are aged between, say, 12 to 17. I mean, that age range, the teenagers, I mean, it's dim. It's not impossible because some do get adopted from time to time. But when you look at the graduation rate, I believe the graduation rate for the nation for black males is close to 52%. This is based on the Schott Foundation. I like to always provide, you know, resources. So, you know, you don't have to take our word for it. This is factual information.
Mm-hmm.
So 52%, you're looking at nearly five out of 10 black males that begin ninth grade, only about half of those, only about five of those, you know, are going to graduate. And it is very critical. I mean, it's very, very critical. And not that we're just trying to push the book, and please understand that this is not about, you know, Daryl and myself trying to, you know, make a few extra bucks or anything like that. But as he mentioned earlier, this is a passion. We've lived through this. He works with black males every day. I work with families every day, all different kinds of families, families that are homeless, individuals that come knocking on our office door that are looking for and seeking refuge because the wife or the mother is being battered, and she has with her, what, usually black boys that are seeing this. So, I mean, when we talk about domestic violence, we talk about education, and we talk about foster care and how all of that affects the family. One of the things that we have to share as well is that in the creation of 12 Things Every Black Boy Needs to Know, or 12 Things, as we've been saying, Daryl had the text, and they were originally 52 things. And we scaled it down to 12, and out of the 12 that Dr. Holyfield has, we try to identify and say, okay, now given these 12 things, which one do you think should be the very, very first thing that the reader should read? And we came to the conclusion that, you know, thing number one, the mind is an important thing to develop. You know, we were talking about just a few moments ago, how important it is for, or what kind of impact did we have growing up, with whether our father was in our life or not in our lives, or what has gone on, you know, in our to make our circumstances, you know, very, very unique, or why is it that, you know, black males aren't excelling, you know, when they go to these workshops that we're always talking about. Well, first they have to realize that the mind itself is a very, very important thing to develop. And so once we're able to get our young men's minds back on track and they understand who they are, which speaks to thing number seven, knowing thyself, once those two things, you know, couple together, then we can begin to see improvements in education.
You know, and in terms of
in a decrease, you know, in violence in our own communities as well as other communities. And so, you know, and then that way we'll tend to value life, you know, a lot more. You know, once we decide and find out who we are, whose we are, and how important it is to develop our mind and to live a productive life.
Okay. Life is like a card game. You have to play your hand to win. How does one make a weak hand strong?
You make a weak hand strong by throwing out cards that shouldn't be in there and picking up cards that should be. So, you know, as a baby, as the book would say, you're dealt an imaginary deck of cards at birth that you have no control over, because you're born into a world, and so whatever that hand is, that's what you get. If it's good health, if it's a disease, if it's poverty, whatever it is, you had no control over that because you were a baby. But as you get older and you can make more choices, then you can start choosing friends. You can choose to smoke weed. You can choose to drop out of school. So therefore, you're making your hand weak. So those are cards you pull from the deck. So some of those cards you can throw out. You can let go of a bad friendship, even though it's hard. You can let go of a bad friendship. You can let go of a habit like smoking marijuana, or you can pick up a mentor from a deck if your father's not there. So
and
that's how you make your hand strong by getting rid of the wrong cards and holding on to the right cards and picking up better cards for you.
Okay. Hold your thought for a second. We've got to take a brief break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. This is Dr. Liz Holyfield. Joining me here in the studio is Terrence Starks, Brandon DeJesus, got it right, Adika Trimble joins us from Atlanta, and Daryl Starks also from Atlanta. We have been talking about the black male. Why are apologies so important? I know that's one of your things, one of your chapters. Would you talk about apologies and why they are important?
Gladly. When we were growing up, and this is just my theory, when we were growing up, the 3 R's are reading, writing, and arithmetic. But my theory now is that the 3 R's are reading, relationships, and resiliency. So the relationship piece is so important because you have to have the right people on your team throughout life. You know, it's not something, like I said, it's not who you know. It's not what you know, it's who you know. So a lot of times young people will make mistakes, have a bad day at school, and, you know, irritate a teacher and get written up and get a bad reputation, or they'll do something at home and don't apologize to their mom. So that whole thing about apologizing is to keep the right people on your team, to keep your network strong so you're not burning your bridges, which is another thing in the book, don't burn your bridges. So that's why the apology is important, because we're all human. We all have feelings and emotions. And when you do someone wrong, it's important to apologize so that person will give you a second chance and still treat you the right way. So many black boys, or so many youth in general, are flagged in schools, especially in schools, because they might have done something in third grade that might carry mm-hmm. with them
Indeed.
Through high school. If they just get that bad reputation. So, you know, making things right is a very, very important skill in life.
How do they avoid the punk image, or, you know, maintain their machismo image? Because apologizing doesn't go along with that particular image so often that young black males feel like they have to portray.
Well, I think it can be done in a combination of ways, and especially when it comes to adults. So, you know, in the book we have a sample letter where a young man can read our sample letter, and it'll help them put their thoughts on paper, so you can inconspicuously give a letter to a teacher and your friends might not even see it. But mm-hmm. you still did the deed of apologizing. That's just one way to do
mm-hmm.
it. Or, you know, you might be able to pull them to the side and talk to them on the side, because I know they do have to have their image, they have their swag and the whole thing that's important to them. But at the end of the day, their relationship is also important. So they just have to find the right way to do that, either through a letter, email, phone call, you know, a one-on-one conversation. But they need to have the conversation and not do what so many kids try to do, is impress their friends and not try to impress the adults who can do something for them in life.
And actually, I would like to ask Terrence and or Brandon, either one of you young men, do you all find it hard? Sometimes we might find it a little bit easier to apologize to the young ladies, like, oh, girl, you know I didn't mean to do that. But, you know, in terms of your peers, your male peers, that is, do either of you find it hard, or can you all remember a particular situation where it was kind of difficult? You knew you were wrong, but will you all found it difficult to apologize?
Well, personally, I don't like to apologize because I got too much pride, for one. And, that's the only problem I have about it. But I do it anyway for the greater good. But at the end of the day, I beat myself up over it because, you know, of the pride situation again. Because if I never did anything wrong, then I wouldn't have had to correct myself and apologize later.
What about you, Terrence?
It's never easy to just be wrong because everybody wants to be right. You know, and you're never going to be right if you're, like, arguing with a woman. So you might as well just apologize, you know. Just suck up your pride, you know. And
I believe that as we grow older and hopefully a little wiser, you know, as men, as young men, as older men, we tend to, in that wisdom, we tend to do it because it's the right thing to do.
Right.
You know, we know that sometimes it can affect, you know, your swag or your job performance. You know, if you're working, but sometimes, you know, you do it because that's the right thing to do. One of the things that I try to do is I try to make sure that I cover all my bases first, because I'm kind of like yourself. I don't like apologizing, but I try to make sure that I'm right so I don't have to apologize.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, you know, but we felt that it was very critical to put that particular chapter, that particular thing, apologize when you do someone wrong in the book, because a lot of young men, as you said, Dr. Hollyfield, they feel like, you know, if they mistakenly steps on someone's shoe, they're in the hallway at school and mistakenly steps on someone's shoe, they feel that, you know, they don't necessarily have to apologize, but then what usually happens is a fight may ensue as a result of that pride, when all they had to do is say, oh, man, my bad, I'm sorry, or, no, I didn't mean it, you know. But, you know, sometimes we get these airs, and there's no reason or rationalization, you know, for having these airs. You know, we just have them because we want to look good, you know, as Derek was saying, you know, in front of our peers or in front of our friends. But there again, like I said, as we get older, you know, we get a little bit more mature, and we understand that, you know, people make mistakes, we make mistakes, and apology is just simply a part of life. You know, that's just how it is.
Well, how does
can I piggyback real quick on
that? Sure,
sure. I learned something a while back in church that ties, that really cements this chapter for me, and it basically, my pastor basically said, every conversation you don't have remains alive in the conversations you do have. So if you do someone wrong and they know you did it wrong, you can be talking about a casual conversation, but in the back of their mind, they still remember what you did wrong because you didn't put it to bed with an apology or trying to make that right. So, and I see that a lot of times in relationships at work and at, you know, at home or with different people, you know, you can have a surface conversation, but under that surface is there's still some emotions and some feelings that haven't been dealt with because somebody didn't come clean with something.
How does one convince young black males that it's easier to stay out of trouble than to get out of trouble before they get into trouble?
Wow. That's a really fun chapter to do as I do the field test and the work with the kids in the different communities and schools. I guess the best way I can put it is, you know, everybody won't make it. It's not that everybody can't make it. It's just some won't do what it takes to make it. So some people have to learn the hard way. And I think a lot of times in bumping the head enough or, you know, whatever that rough situation is, that might be what it takes to wake them up. Whereas some people can, you know, touch the stove and know it's hot. You know, some people can look at the stove and see that person got burnt, so I'm not touching the stove. So some people, I think some young people will have to experience the rougher side of things and learn that it's harder to get out of trouble, and some can look at it and say, you know, I'm not trying to go there because, you know, the goals I have in life, you know, this trouble would take me off my path or take me out of my lane. So I think it's a combination of the two. So we share the concept, we teach the concept. At the end of the day, everybody internalizes it differently. Some have to learn the hard way, and some get it just from understanding, you know, that, you know, they're so focused on goals, they're so focused on staying out of trouble or doing the right thing or not having to apologize that they do the right thing the first time.
How does one, as we come to...
You don't necessarily have to convince them, you know, that it's easy to stay out of trouble than to get out of trouble, because all they have to do is simply look around. I mean, we can remember when we were in elementary school, middle school, high school, or even now, just even in life. But as students, sometimes when something would go wrong within the school, we usually knew that it was going to be student A, B, or C, because they have, you know, created a pattern. You know, one of the things is your past behavior, the predictor of your future behavior tends to be your past behavior. So when a principal will come into a room and say, look, somebody, you know, has, you know, somebody egged my car. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, you know, all the students going to look at that one particular student, even if they didn't do it, because they have a pattern. They have a pattern of behavior. So I think individuals, you know, they go through and they understand, you know, the importance of the decisions that they make. And for individuals that tend not to, you know, get in trouble, or at least not as much, hopefully, you know, Terrence and Brandon fall in that category, they, you know, have been able to witness, well, yeah, you know, so-and-so usually has, you know, negative behaviors. So if anything goes down, you know, the teacher or the principal is going to usually, you know, suspect that student, even if that student may happen to be, you know, innocent in that one instance.
Indeed. How does one overcome culture? Because sometimes culture is in conflict.
You wouldn't mind being more specific, Dr. Hollyfield. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, our culture, for example, playing the dozens, okay? And that's something that's passed from, you know, one generation to another generation to another generation. Now, when we played the dozens, nobody got mad and shot each other. Okay. Now they still play them, but the outcome is different.
That's a good question. I don't know if you overcome culture. I mean, I love black mm-hmm. culture. I just think there's some street mentality that's kind of weaved in there that kind of has a more dysfunctional twist to it. So overcoming culture, I don't know, but I guess mm-hmm. learning how to play the game and still win is, I think that's the bigger challenge.
Okay.
Now, so I guess, and I think a lot of that, you know, they say you're a product of your environment, but I really firmly believe that you're not necessarily a product of your environment, but you're a product of your exposure. You're a product of your experiences, your education, your engagements. There's so many things that you're a product of that can help you kind of beat that culture if you're in a negative setting. But you've got to experience other things that help you see a bigger picture. I mean, your perspective on whatever is going on around you, that's your perspective. But if you're elevated above that, as I call it, lame, you know, a level above my environment, if you get above that, you can see that there's other things out there for you. But you've got to be able to kind of transcend that to see that there are bigger things out there. So, but I don't know if you want to disassociate from your culture, because we have a wonderful culture as black people. But there's certain elements that are kind of dysfunctional that we might want to move forward, move beyond, so we can accomplish those big things. And we have, you know, young men in school, to be a doctor, and I forgot what the other one mentioned, but you can't get caught up in, you know, the street mentality and aspire to those kind of dreams. It makes it very, very difficult. So somehow you got to be able to transcend it and move forward and still kind of respect it for what it is, because it's just going to take a whole lot to change a lot of what's going on at that level.
Yeah.
Go right ahead, Brandon.
Yeah, I like his response. But like he said, I don't think you can overcome culture myself. I think it's just a fact of, like, making statistics better, you know? Like, mm-hmm. I attend FAMU, and, you know, statistically, black people can't succeed in all categories. But FAMU is a HBCU, and, like, I guess we're slowly making statistics better because, you know, everybody's there to either become a doctor, pharmacist, this and that, you know. So we're slowly making it better.
Okay. Yeah. Have things changed? And this is for Adika and Daryl. How have things changed for black males today compared to when you were young? Or maybe I should ask, have things changed?
Yes, things have definitely changed. Things have definitely changed on so many different levels. When we look at our education system, and we tend to continue to go back to education because that is the foundation. Malcolm said that, you know, that is our passport to the future. So when we look at the education system of yesterday's, and when I'm saying yesterday's, maybe the 70s and the 80s compared to today, or even going pre-70, the 1960s, the 1950s, the 1940s, things have just become so more advanced. We have first seen the demise of the black family. And when you look at it, see, when we just identify or kind of isolate, you know, black boys, even though that's our topic, but we have to look at the entire picture. And when we began seeing fathers that were not in the home, not that they weren't involved, but like I said, there are many fathers that are involved that are not in the home, but when we systematically saw fathers moving out of the home, or mothers and fathers not getting married and raising their children together, that's when we saw the demise. And so that just allows for all of these other elements of negativity, violence, and other things to come into play. So it has to do with building the family unit. And, of course, this is, you know, biblical. You know, Adam and Eve were you know, set here on earth, and then they had a family. They raised a family together. And when we even look at history, most of our civil rights leaders, particularly the men, they had great, strong women behind them, and they had families. I still have yet to really read up on a civil rights icon that didn't have a family, that was a maybe a player, you know, so to speak, or someone that's just out there. You know, most of them had families. Even if they were not married, they still had, you know, and believed in the family unit. So that has a lot to do with where we are today. So we've seen the demise of the black family, which has resulted in a lot of our black boys, particularly, not half of them graduating from high school, even less than that, graduating from college. Unemployment is still, you know, continues to run rampant, and it has a higher percentage than that, you know, of our Caucasian counterparts. So all of that has to play in the family unit, you know, and we do have those, you know, many, many different positive examples out there, such as an Alonzo Herndon, the founder of the Atlanta Life Insurance Company, who was actually born a slave, but then yet became the country's first black millionaire right here in Atlanta. So you know, he was taught how to read and write. And just imagine, you know, all of the challenges, you know, that he and his mom went through. And his father was a Caucasian slave owner, you know. So, but he was able to still, as Daryl explained in Enhancement, dealt, find positive men and able to overcome those challenges that were placed before him. And there are just many, many others, you know, from the Malcolm X's, you know, that had their fathers and saw images of their fathers, to the Martin Luther King Jr.'s, you know, that had their fathers, you know, involved in their lives. So I think it just goes back to that family unit, the core family unit, that makes the difference between our yesterdays and today.
Okay. Well, listen, we are out of time. I would just like to extend to you sincere appreciation for you all sharing the information about your book. And to my students, I appreciate you for participating. Next week, you need to tune in, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical engineer, Evan Rossi. Audio copies are available, and if you would like to participate in 411 Teen or have topic suggestions, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. That's 1-800-829-8809. Extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen Podcast, log in wfsu.org.